A book called The Social Life of Tea has just been released, tracing extraordinary human interaction with the wood that has been coveted and fought over, cherished and exploited for centuries. At the book's launch in Chiang Mai, the authors Virginia Henderson and Tim Webster show photos and talk of the stories they collected from almost 300 interviews with people living in the teak zone across South and Southeast Asia. Many of their accounts are from Myanmar or Burma, where the idea for creating this social history of teak was born. From 2015 to 2019, they talked to people in villages, forests, sawmills, wood factories, and even high officials about how teak has shaped their lives. We invited Virginia and Tim to our newsroom today. Welcome to DPP Newsroom, Tim and Virginia. What struck me most in your book is the connection of oral history to teak. And it is an incredible listening project. What did you try to catch from those oral histories? And how did you decide that who you talked to? And what did they tell you about the state of teak in Burma?
This book came out on the back of our previous book, Yangon Echoes, which is also a collection of oral histories. And in this book, we try to show a real breadth of perspectives and experiences. So we cast a very wide net, let's say, and asked for our connections to advise us where we should look.
It's really a cultural history of a natural resource. And since we were living in Yangon for a while, we got to understand quite quickly as we met people and moved around town the importance of this material on a daily basis in many people's lives. So what struck us quite quickly also was the demand for this product can be very elevated. It's actually a precious resource, and yet also the ecosystems from which this resource is derived have spiritual and practical sort of day-to-day meaning for a lot of people in Myanmar.
Thank you, Tim. You mentioned some of the rarest insights you had was when you were invited by the Myanmar government to visit and document the activities of the state-owned Myanmar timber enterprise. Let's look at some of those photos. What did people you talked to tell you about the extraction industry?
Tim wrote to the Myanmar Timber Enterprise and asking for permission in those days when that was possible. And after some great follow-up, they agreed and gave him a letter which he was able to take and go to the jungle camps for timber extraction with elephants, and also into the production factories, the plywood, the furniture.
Yes, so a lot of that material came from about 2017. The export of whole teak logs had been banned by the government since 2014. And there was also an awareness after the recent history that actually there was a problem in that the extraction of teak was in no way sustainable, that a lot had been taken because there was a revenue-driven approach to harvesting, which meant that under a previous government, a financial target was chosen, and then regardless of what the forest ecosystems could support, a certain amount of money had to be made, and that was due to sanctions and other reasons. The government needed money by hook or by crook. But what that led to was devastation of places like the Bagoyoma and previously areas around Pumina and Mandalay. In fact, wherever teak was growing, too much had been taken. So at that time, There was a conscious effort by the government to improve the conservation of teak as a resource. So the amount of trees that could be cut each year had been radically reduced. However, there were also other initiatives, such as in the days of most devastation, companies had come in with a lot of high-tech equipment, and that in turn putting roads through the forest and using large vehicles and mechanical extraction had also led to further diminution of the resource. So it was actually a great privilege for me to spend time with the Sin Uzi and in an elephant camp where traditional extraction was still practiced. Myanmar is the only country in the world where this still happens, and the elephants are very gentle, intelligent and sensitive to their surrounds. So this is a much more environmentally friendly way of realizing this resource.
Yeah. In your book, I found a very interesting story told by a thief. He talked about what is called a small thief and the biggest thieves. So can you please explain a little bit about that military exploitation and illegal logging in that area, how that impact on Burma teak forest?
So a lot of people in Myanmar rely on the forest, not just for wood. In fact, our book is about forests, trees, and wood. So the forest obviously is an ecosystem that not only is a larder, providing things like mushrooms and small animals, even the leaves are used for packaging, as well as dyes and fibers and medicines. Many people, as you know, don't have a lot of money in some parts of Myanmar, so part of their livelihood still relies on the forest. Obviously, there was always a degree of illegal logging, but more than that, systematic looting of the forests in the name of export. And so even while we were creating this, teak was going out via back doors to places in Europe. And even though there's law stopping that within the EU, some countries are more open to accessing illegal timber shipments than others. It's interesting because in some ways there were the large, bad, greedy companies who made a lot of money and then have left teak logging completely and established, you know, hotels, airlines, banks, things like that. Mm. And then there's also the death of the thousand cuts, where the, even on a village level, people take small logs.
Your book has many stories about the spiritual connection that teak has. Let's look at this picture, a 20th century Bagan style wood carving from Mandalay. So tell us about this story, please.
We do know that teak is revered, and it's used when paying respect to the gods, the best materials must be chosen, and teak is chosen. Because of its characteristics, it's durable, it's workable for carvers, and it's long-lasting. That's the most important thing, that it's made to last.
It said so much about the history of great carving skills in Myanmar, and in fact the history of teak use. No one is exactly sure, but there's an understanding that perhaps for the last 2,000 years people have been carving teak in Myanmar, because few missionaries actually went to China with teak in, instruments, and this has been recorded. The panels, there are four of them. They are 8 feet square, each made of up to 10 different pieces of teak. It took 24 carvers 1 month to realize that commission to be hung in a university. The most amazing thing is the detail and actually the expertise of Myanmar people in carving wood. Yeah.
In one photo, we see an ancient teak coffin in a cave. What did you hear about indigenous perspective and spiritual understanding of teak forest?
Yes, this coffin is actually in Pang Ma Pa out of Mae Hong San. And the group of young archaeologists working there to date it are still unsure about that. But there was a practice throughout Southeast Asia, actually, in pockets of it, of this kind of burial practice.
And of course, this image, as much as it's over the border, you know, ethnic people, as we know, don't necessarily follow political lines drawn on a map so much as through their communities. So this practice is actually right throughout Kaya State as well. And so, you know, it's a sign of reverence for the material as well as its longevity, that our loved ones could be celebrated by putting them in a cave. However, there's also quite a bit of folklore involved in this as well, such as the Jat people, who are legendary forest people, quite big, hairy, something like the Yeti in Tibet. And it's been put to us that some of these coffins are actually made by people who are not like us. They've been worked in different ways. Some of the coffins have breast shapes on the lids, and some of them are up to 12 or 16 feet in length. So there's still some work to be done in terms of trying to understand the provenance of this use of teak.
Wow, you met many people working with teak, such as planters, traders, makers and weavers. Tell us about their stories.
Yeah, this is a family, and we love this picture because it's almost totally organic. You know, the materials of their house, their roof, the walls, baskets and brooms. This family live in amongst the young teak plantation and up to about 7 years. They require in plantations, people will grow small crops, chilies, beans, and perhaps rice while the teak is still short, and then they will move. And these are three brothers who are continuing their father's tradition of making wheels for carts, cartwheel making brothers. They had made, I think, 40 the year before we took this photo, and the number was down to 10. But they figured that they would keep going. But this reflects the diminishing use of cartwheels because people were not actually working in the fields as required, their more urban work. This is a furniture maker using shellac to cover the furniture. It's in Yangon, very near where we were living. It's like a French polish, this yellow colour, and it's hard work.
These women, their job at the moulding factory is to match up small pieces of teak for the production of pake, for which teak is also very famous.
In this photo, women said a teak loom weaving, and her area has become a conflict zone today. News reports say that many women lost their weaving looms when their houses were burned down by the regime soldiers. Did you hear any news about some of those people you interviewed? How their life has been changed?
That's a really good question, and we've been making best efforts to reach out to our storytellers in the book, because this is the most important part for us. One of the very beautiful things is to take this book back to the people who are in it and give them their copy. This is Zaza San in Pia village outside Gangor, and you're right, this has been a place of conflict right now, and we cannot reach their family. She is one of four sisters, and they run this weaving textile factory basically underneath their house, so they live upstairs. But Yeah, most importantly, we look forward to a time when we can go and go back and visit our friends and share this work with them, their stories, their photos.
And in the meantime, hope that people are as safe as possible.
I saw the picture of Dimthit, a poet and a former MP who became Minister of the Defense, Ministry of the National Unity Government. He was standing in front of the incredible tick doors in Naypyidaw in Parliament. This image sums up how much things have changed. Mm. How did you take that into account with the book coming out now?
Yeah, so it was extraordinary for us to be invited into the Pidongsu Lator. What a place. It's like a huge palace full of such riches of Myanmar, wide floors, extensive use of teak. So it was a great opportunity, actually, just in an architectural sense. But as you say, it's very telling of how much things have changed, because there was an openness and a willingness to share with us even some of the past that maybe people found problematic. But that was in the name of hopefully improving the situation going forward, and that there could be some resolution. Same thing actually in dealing with Myanmar timber enterprise itself. Even at that time, there was like a division among the staff. Some people were still, had gained their position under military control, and the other group of people were professional foresters, academics, people that had studied properly. So these things sort of came together in situations like this, because as much as we were invited, sometimes by some people, we had to check that it was still okay with other people. So we're still making our best efforts to try and reach out to everyone that we can still find at the moment.
Well, thank you so much, Virginia and Tim, and also thanks for your incredible job you have done regarding Myanmar tick forest and an oral history of people who are living with tick in their life. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.